This is Getting the Buggers to Behave 2 by Sue Cowley, read by David Brain. Managing the first meeting. Why is the first meeting so important? Your first meeting with any class offers you the chance to sow the seeds for an easy year, or to take the first step on the road to disaster. Every teacher must surely know that hollow feeling in the pit of your stomach as you let a new class into your room, aware that what you do in that very first meeting will have such a long-term impact. Often, both the teacher and the students will be feeling at their most defensive in the first lesson together. You may be anticipating poor behavior from a difficult class. They may be expecting you to dislike them if they know that the other teachers feel negatively towards them. With many classes, the first few meetings offer you a honeymoon period, where your students are getting to know you, checking you out, before revealing their true colors. If this is the type of class you have, make sure you don't start out with an overly relaxed attitude. If you do, you may find that a few lessons into the year, when the students have made a decision about your style and personality as a teacher, they start to take advantage of your relaxed approach and begin to misbehave. On the other hand, you may find yourself in a school where the students will misbehave for new teachers, testing them to see whether they can withstand the ordeal. This is obviously the more difficult situation to be in, and if you do find yourself at this type of school, you should very quickly turn to others to help and support you. Some ideas about how you might do this are given in Chapter 11. What do you need to know before the first meeting? Teachers are put in a very difficult position at the start of a school year, or at the start of a term if they begin a new job midway through the year. We are expected to meet, control, and teach a group of young people about whom we know little or nothing. Because of this, we do have a tendency to learn by our mistakes, dealing with problems as they arrive, rather than anticipating them. Time is very precious at the start of term, and the other staff in your school are of course busy setting up their own classrooms, planning their first few lessons, emptying out their pigeonholes from the previous year, and so on. However, because of the vital importance of this first meeting with your new class or classes, it really is worthwhile taking some time to prepare. What exactly can you do in advance of meeting your classes? Here are some ideas for you to consider. Knowledge is power. If possible, do try to find out some information about your students before you meet them for the first time. This will give you an advantage over your class. You know more about them than they do about you. It will also give you a psychological boost that could help you remain calm and confident. Here are some of the types of information that you might find useful. Possible behavior problems. Is there a well-known troublemaker in the class that you should watch out for? If you do know their name and also what is likely to set them off, you can keep an eye out for any early signs of misbehavior. Sometimes a difficult student will be proud of their reputation. By acknowledging that their fame precedes them, you will show them that you are very aware as a teacher, a vital part of your basic armory. See Chapter 1. In addition, you can offer them a chance of a fresh start by pointing out that you will judge them solely by how they behave and work for you. Learning needs. Are there students with non-behavioral special needs that may have an impact on their learning? Such special needs can be perceived incorrectly by the teacher and wrongly interpreted as a behavioral difficulty. For instance, if a student has great difficulty in writing, they may not complete the work set. If you misinterpret this as laziness, you will fail to meet their needs, and you could also provoke misbehavior. Physical needs. Is there a student with a hearing problem or other physical difficulty that you should take into consideration? Although such an impediment may not necessarily be a recipe for misbehavior, there are certain things that you should do as a teacher to avoid embarrassing such a student. For instance, a student with a hearing problem may not follow an instruction because they have not heard you, and you might misinterpret this as rudeness. Knowing the names. It can also be very useful to know the names of one or two of your students, as the class will be amazed and impressed if you can use a name correctly, apparently without ever having been told it. Knowing your students' names really is vital in controlling the class. See Learn Some Names on page 22. In your pursuit of knowledge, do remember that it is vitally important to avoid prejudging your classes. Not only is this likely to put you in a negative frame of mind, it is also unfair on the students. Some students who have a bad reputation in a school are never given a chance to prove this reputation to be false. Give them the chance to impress you, and you may be pleasantly surprised. This is The Laying On of Hands, from Four Stories by Alan Bennett, read by David Brain. Now, as the hymn ended, Father Jolliffe said, "Will you sit?" Gave them a moment to settle, and then launched into his preamble. And straight away came out with something he had no intention of saying. "On such occasions as these," he said, "a priest will often preface his remarks with an apology, craving the forgiveness of the congregation, since they have had the advantage of knowing the deceased, whereas he didn't. I make no such apology. I knew Clive, and like most of you, I imagine, loved him and valued his friendship. Else, why are any of us here?" Treacher, who was not here for that at all, made a neat note on the back of his order of service. Father Jolliffe was amazed at himself. Few people in the congregation were aware he knew Clive, and for various reasons, one of which was prudence, he hadn't been planning to say that he did. Now he had blurted it out and must make the best of it. Though this would be hard, as there was so much he could not say. For the most part, Geoffrey, and there are some circumstances in which it's right he is called Geoffrey and not Father Jolliffe, for the most part, Geoffrey was celibate, though he attached no virtue to this, knowing it was not abstinence so much as lack of opportunity that kept him generally unconjugate. That and a certain timidity where sex was concerned, which made him, despite his mild moral disapproval, bestow on an enterprising promiscuity such as Clive's an almost heroic status. No matter that boldness came as naturally to Clive as difference did to Geoffrey, or that Clive, of course, was much better looking and unburdened by Geoffrey's thoughts of God and not looking a fool. Geoffrey knew that in what nowadays is called a one-to-one situation, he was what he thought of as shy, so that men who weren't shy, such as Clive, seemed to him warriors, their valour, however profligate, more of a virtue than his own timorous drawing back. Geoffrey had had experience at first hand of how fly Clive could be. En route for lunch together along the Farringdon Road, not a thoroughfare Geoffrey had ever thought of in a carnal context, Clive had intercepted a male glance that Geoffrey had not even noticed, and quick as a fish, he had darted away, leaving Geoffrey to eat alone and return home, disconsolate, where Clive duly came by to give an account of his afternoon. True, Clive was not choosy, or how else would he have got into bed with Geoffrey himself? Episodes so decorous that, for Clive, they can scarcely have registered as sex at all, though still tactile enough for Geoffrey, on the news of Clive's death, to be filled with unease. Being of an Anglo-Catholic persuasion, Father Jolliffe practiced auricular confession, when he would come clean about his predilections, an ordeal that was somewhat diminished by choosing as his confessor a clergyman whom he knew had no problem with that, and being of a similar persuasion himself, would place it low down in the hierarchy of possible wickedness. With never much to confess on that particular score, now with Clive gone, there was going to be even less. Somebody coughed. The congregation were waiting, and though the pause while Father Jolliffe wrestled with what he should and should not say was understood to be one of deep personal remembrance, or even a chance to regain control of his feelings, Still, there wasn't all day. Father Jolliffe plunged on, and suddenly it all came right. "We shall be singing some hymns. We shall pray together, and there will be readings and some of Clive's favourite music." Father Jolliffe paused. "Prayer may seem to some of you as an outmoded activity, and hymns too, possibly. But that was not what Clive thought. Clive, as I know personally, was always keen to involve himself in the rites and rituals of the church, and were he here, he would be singing louder and praying harder than anybody."